Rated T to M.
Sibilance. Sibilance.
This show is about conversation.
Conversations with interesting,
creative people.
Creative.
Talented people.
Talented people.
This is Irrational Interrational Interviews.
This is Ken Levine.
And I'm Julian Murdoch.
And we call this show Irrational Interviews. Today on Irrational Interviews, we're going to do something a little different. Normally, we bring in somebody from the outside, and you know, I get the opportunity to talk to them, whether that's Cliff Baczynski or Guillermo del Toro. Today, we're actually going to talk with the actors who are playing Booker and Elizabeth, and spend some time with them. I'm fortunate enough to be able to hang out with them and work with them and watch their process, which is kind of fascinating because, you know, the different places, both Troy Baker, who plays Booker, and Courtney Draper, who plays Elizabeth, you know, they're different backgrounds. I wanted to have them share their stories with you guys, and so we sat down with our host, Julian Murdoch, and we had a chat.
Well, thanks to the three of you for taking some time out in what is clearly a busy part of the schedule. We have some great questions from the community. We're not going to get to them all today, so I've kind of grouped them together into some common themes. A lot of them are about the actual process. You've shared some great video footage of the actual booth process, and I think that view of the inside has really captured people's interest. So let's jump in with one great question that came in from Mark Wanizek. He said, how did you guys actually come up with the voices for the characters? Did you develop them yourself, or did Ken kind of say, I want this and that out of the character? Maybe Courtney, you could kick that one off.
Originally, I thought, oh, I'm just doing my voice. This is just how I sound. And then when my friends and family finally saw the demo, they're like, wow, it doesn't really sound that much like you. So apparently I'm doing something. I don't know exactly what it is.
Really? They said that? 'Cause I'm surprised because we didn't really
try to
do any voices.
Yeah. Maybe something just kicks in when I'm acting that I don't know. But then in the last recording session, Ken had wanted me to stay like in a lower register. So now I mean, that's something distinct and conscious that I'm trying to do. Other than that, I feel like I'm pretty much just trying to be me.
Interesting. How about you, Troy?
Yeah, I think with me, the biggest stretch for me is I'm such a loud, talkative person and Booker's not. So I think the main difference between my natural speaking voice and his is just simply the fact that I'm not being loud and an idiot. But yeah, I think really the focus for both of us, and this kind of came down from Ken, was just to be as natural as possible. We're not doing caricature-y stuff. It's just the characters more in the dialogue and the story. So that really kind of comes through, and it's just us kind of talking and walking through it.
Yeah, I mean, the primary direction I give them in terms of this, and there's not very much, is generally I tell Troy to
drain the swamp.
To drain the swamp. I mean, just trust that Booker's a guy of few words, and he's a guy that doesn't want to betray what he's thinking. So a lot of times, I think Troy very naturally tries to inject a little more life than I would want in the delivery. And I think we found the more we end up just trusting the line, when I say the line, sometimes it's not my line. Sometimes it's Troy's line. I'm not saying it's like, oh, do what the fuck I say. You know, sometimes Troy will come up with a line. But trusting that minimalism has worked really well. And for Courtney, just keeping her in her lower register, because I think that's where most of the takes I chose for Elizabeth ended up in the first time through. And I think it just suits the character. I mean, she's a singer, so she's got a broad range she can cover. So I just try to keep her in the lower side of that for the work.
That plays into another set of questions we've had, which was about actually casting for these kinds of characters. Are you casting actors or are you casting voices? I mean, do you think about it differently there?
You hear how they inhabit the lines. And I generally have no idea going in what I'm going to want. And then you hear that person. And with Troy, I heard it and I was very tuned in immediately that he inhabited that part the way I sort of hoped it could be inhabited. And that's what you're really looking for. Is it inhabited or not? Without a preconception. And when I heard Troy, I definitely right away thought that he was inhabiting it. And with Courtney, it was bizarre because the audition she did, I didn't for some reason get it. That she was that part. And then Christina, who works with me, said, listen, you really should listen to this again. And I listened to it again. The moment I listened to it again, I'm like, oh my God, that's our Elizabeth. What the hell was I thinking? It was interesting.
I mean, this gets to another question we had from Zach Nathanson, and maybe I'll turn this back to you, Courtney, again. You know, we had that sort of really emotional video of you in the booth, really get, as Ken said, really inhabiting the character in the moment. Did you stay in character during the sessions for Bioshock Infinite? I mean, where do you, how deeply do you stay in character for a whole session?
I mean, I'd like to sound really pretentious and say, oh, I'm this great method actor that does all these conscious things, but the truth of it is I just innately tap into Elizabeth. And then that's something that Ken's kind of pointed out, like the emotional stuff, granted in the video clip that people have seen, that was, you know, this kind of all of us working together to help push me to that point. But a lot of that emotional stuff that she has, I just naturally very quickly tap into. And Ken has pointed that out to me and said, wow, like you really just go there, don't you? And for whatever reason, I do. I just, it's not like a conscious thing. I'm not pushing really hard to try and stay in character the whole time or try and push Elizabeth to a certain emotional point. I mean, a lot of the times when I'm crying in the booth or I've, you know, have tears coming down or whatever, Ken didn't write that or Ken didn't say, I want you to cry during this. It's just things that naturally, you know, things that naturally kind of are brought out and come out. There's something mysterious even to me about Elizabeth that on a guttural level I just connect with. I'm not able to intellectualize that verbally to you because I don't understand it myself. It's just one of those connections that you can't explain, I guess.
Troy, you do a ton of voice work. I mean, your video game credits are, you know, as long as my arm. Do you approach this kind of work differently than, say, doing something live action?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically just because the mechanics are different. I've done on-camera stuff, and the thing that I love about voice work, and specifically voice work in games, is that I can literally be anything, anybody. I've played Conan the Barbarian, and you would never cast me in that movie, but it's all about the way that you approach it and the way that you present the character. And not being bound to the physicality of it really opens up a lot of doors. Obviously, depending upon the game, you're going to approach it from a different mindset. But with me, as far as like getting into character, how long do you stay in character? I've found that with me, if I have 1 second to think about it, I'll screw it up. I'll totally blow it. And that's one more thing I really count on Ken to kind of guide me through. And that's where the whole Drain the Swamp thing came in, because I want to add something to it. I want to do something interesting. But when you're starting off with something interesting, all the prettying up and dressing it up really is just stripping away the core essence of it. And so specifically with Booker, it's almost like, you know, when you see someone running down the street and they're at that stoplight and they can't go and they're just kind of jogging in place. That's kind of what I do, but I'm doing it in a way that I'm distracting myself. So I'm keeping myself from staring at the line, because if there's 3 words on a page, I will find 16 different ways to say those 3 words. And so I really just try to approach this as, I heard a brilliant thing Mickey Rourke said one time. He was like, dialogue is the last thing that I learn. Because if I understand the character and the script's good, it should just flow out. And that's really what we have here. We have solid characters and we have a solid story. So it's not really a matter of memorization or really having to find an interesting way to deliver the line. It's just like Ken said, inhabit the character and it's just going to flow out. And I think that's where we're at so far.
We had a follow-up question from Mark Wasnick, who was saying, you know, what were you looking to do here when you were scripting this game? A lot of people have commented in the forums that, you know, you've taken your known propensity for storytelling and you kind of upped the ante by making the main character, the character that the actual player inhabits, have his own voice, have his own lines, have his own direction. Is that a big stretch for you as a writer? And how did you think about the voice acting to go with that?
The fact that there is dialogue between these two main characters has been the hardest part. Because we did, you know, I worked a little bit on prototypical lines for Garrett in the original Thief. And, you know, he has sort of the similar vibe of talking to himself. Not having sort of that Atlas character talking in your ear, having a lot of the exposition coming from two characters in a dialogue, especially two characters who don't know the world that they're walking through the way that Atlas knew Rapture. That's been a real challenge figuring that out. And most of the challenge is every time you write a line, you realize it's probably should be about a third as long as it actually is, because you have this time pressure, because you never know what's going to happen. So you really have to make these things, get this story across as compactly as possible.
We had a specific question about this from his username Projectionist on the forums. He asked whether for the voice actors, whether it was difficult to act knowing that each player was going to be going through this game, making different decisions and having a different experience of it. So you might be, you know, your lines may be saying one thing, but the player might be having a different context for those lines. Did you think about that at all?
Where games are at right now, I look at Naughty Dog, for example, to where you've got, and really what Bioshock does too, it takes even a step further to where you've got not just cutscenes gameplay, but you have actually all these things that are happening in gameplay. And so the thing that Ken and I have really tried to focus on is making sure that we don't put the player in a box, because that's when it gets gamey. And that's when it really takes away from what Bioshock really is that it is a truly immersive experience to where the player has control constantly. And there's, of course, going to be some paths that Ken has specifically led. No matter what you do, it's going to lead to this so that it can propel the story forward. But you always want to make the player feel like, A, there's multiple decisions and there's consequences for each of those decisions. And so we do have to constantly think about, and this is one thing that when we first started this off back in February, I sat down with Ken and I was like, man, well, what we're trying to do is really ambitious, and it could fail miserably, because it's not about the story. It's not about the dialogue. It's the fact that we're giving a voice to a first person character, and that's never been done before. And especially when you have a character like Booker, who's very stoic, very quiet, doesn't say anything until he thinks about it. And then you have no eyes, no face, nothing but two hands to sell that intention. That's really risky, because it could come across as flat. And so we're constantly thinking from the player's perspective. Ken's, especially when he's writing, I can't put the player in this box because it's going to get frustrating, and then we get gamey and we don't want to do that. So anything that becomes gamey, we immediately throw out. But yeah, we're constantly thinking from three different perspectives, not only as a developer, as an actor, but also as a player, so that we're really giving it the best experience and we're not limiting the player in that experience.
Courtney, from your perspective, not having come at this from really a deep video game acting background, you're better known as doing, you know, some of the serial TV that my kids grew up watching. You know, does that experience change when you're starting to think about, well, this line's going to get delivered, but maybe it won't, or maybe it'll get delivered over in this part of the game?
One, I feel like the learning curve is pretty steep for this. Like Troy and Ken, and I mean, everyone at Irrational has been really helpful in trying to answer all of my questions. I mean, I'm constantly asking questions about the process, because for me, it's a completely new world and I'm kind of becoming in love and obsessed with it. So I want to be gaining as much information as possible. So I feel like little by little, I'm starting to tap in and understand more how the video game experience works. But for some reason, I mean, even Ken at my callback said, wow, like you seem to really understand what we're trying to do here. I feel like even though I may not have had the actual hands-on experience, I can understand mechanically what they're trying to do. I kind of have an innate understanding for it. Obviously, the specifics of it, I don't understand nearly as well as Troy gets it. But it's something that I'm learning more and more in. I like the fact that I don't really understand it, because there's no sense of me being jaded. I'm not trying to game my lines in a certain way. It's just very natural. And I think that Ken talks about the genius and the novice. And I think that's what makes this work and what makes us even more connected to our characters, because Elizabeth is exploring a world for the first time. And all those things kind of are unfolding as an actor and also unfolding in the character. And that's what makes her seem more real, because I'm exploring Columbia for the first time too, in a way, if that makes sense.
I still haven't figured out who I am in that analogy with the genius and the novice.
I like to think that I'm both, but no.
They throw that out, I'm like, I am one of those, right? So I'm feeling somewhere, right?
I think it's really interesting. A lot of times Troy and I can huddle and, you know, really go deep on, you know, okay, well, in the actual game, what's going to happen here? And that's been very helpful to me, but it's kind of been really interesting to me how little or never Courtney's got caught up by the fact that she doesn't understand sort of what we're trying to do when we have a line that can be said, and when we're doing a scene that's a totally different version of the same thing because it's a different path the player may have taken.
I think Courtney tolerates us in those moments too, because we're going, if we had the goblin blood from Endor, we could totally take over the world and we would level up and the XP would be amazing. And Courtney's just over there texting going, they'll stop in a second. It's okay. It's okay.
These boys.
You know, together as a group, I think it's a really good mix of experience. And I think like Booker and Elizabeth, Troy and Courtney each bring a different thing in very similar to their characters, as I think Courtney was saying. And they bring different things to that, which is, I think, is very positive.
What I'm realizing more and more is that, you know, I didn't enter the gaming world younger, besides Nintendo, which is still my claim to fame, because of a lot of different reasons. One of them being that I fell into a stereotype that, oh, like, that's just You know, my mother would be like, that's a waste of time. Like, go read your books. And now that I'm in this world, I'm like, that's so wrong. Like, this is so highly technical, so innovative, so smart, so intelligent. And that's why I think that I maybe don't get as tripped up, because I don't understand the video game mechanics. But what I do understand is, like, it's very intellectual and it's very, like, philosophical, some of the things that Ken is trying to do. And in this game, some political aspects as well. And those are three things that I've not been doing in video games, but that's kind of the three aspects of my intellectual side that I've been doing my entire life. So I think that's why I innately just get it and I like it.
So Ken, we had this follow-up question to this, you know, this idea that you've got a team, right? I mean, you listen to the three of you talk, you clearly have a chemistry, you're working together to build the story. This is kind of a new process for you. I mean, you're known for being very iterative, for throwing a lot of things out, for keeping the creative process moving all the way through development, not just laying out a blueprint and filling out all the blanks. Now that you've got this character in Elizabeth that Courtney's portraying for us, where you not only have dialogue, but you have this third party that you're looking at, you need to animate her. She has to respond in certain physical ways too. Has it changed the development process beyond the sound design? Because now, do you get in the booth, get a reading from Courtney that's like, oh gosh, that's great, and make that have to change what's actually going on with the character that we're seeing on the screen?
Yeah, I mean, look, we do this whether it's an actor having an inspiration, and then you're a fool if you don't take advantage of that inspiration. And you need to be flexible enough to do that. You know, if it's a level builder who comes up with a great idea that is something I can then go off and write off of, or an artist, or even the programming coming up with a feature that we can exploit. As a writer, you want to embrace all the bursts of inspiration every single person has around you, because you've got to be greedily gobbling that up, because that's what makes your job a lot easier. That's why I like waiting a little longer than some people do. I like being in the recording sessions, because I get to sort of see all that content and then the writing benefits from it.
We had another question from Kate Mann on the forums, who asked, has the work the actor's done actually changed the story for you in any ways? Have you sort of rewritten whole scenes because something that might have been angry is now something that might be sad?
Well, we all laughed.
Last recording session, you know, I had this one line that I wrote that in the entire, like, 3 days of writing I did for the recording session, I was really proud of this one line. I actually read it to my wife, Meredith. I'm like, oh, baby, listen to this. This line's going to fucking, it's going to blow their minds.
Now my greatness will be shown in this line.
They'll finally respect me. And Troy gets the line and he reads it, and this isn't Troy's fault. The thing is a fucking dud. And
it's so bad.
It was like the worst line.
It was a David Caruso line. It was like, yeah. I wanted to whip off my glasses and hear the hey at the end of it.
It's probably maybe the worst line that we actually tried to record in the project. And then what we did is, you know, we sort of talked about it, and then I went home and I rewrote the scene, and the next day we did it. And, you know, I came in, you know, my tail between my legs a little bit. And
hang on a second, because you're glossing over something that I thought was really huge that happened there. It wasn't just like, oh, well, it doesn't work, we move on. Here we are, and this never happens. You never have, typically you'll have a director, you'll have maybe the writer and the audio lead that are there. So you've got three different people with three different perspectives that are all trying to get their way and believe that their way is right. With Ken, we essentially have that in one person, because we've got the editor-in-chief there, we've got the writer and the director in one, and so he's incredibly married to his content. You would never, ever believe that this person would be able to disassociate himself from his own work, be objective enough to go, wow, that really doesn't work. And then we all powwow together and try to come up with something, and then we decide, you know what, I'm just going to go back and I'm going to write something. So you're being very, very modest, but the humility that was displayed, it's never seen. And Courtney and I talked about this in a different interview. Typically, when you get the level of talent and the level of success that Ken has had, something falls by the wayside. And typically, it's that humility. And the hubris is just, you know, rampant. But what Ken is able to do, though, which is really surprising, is, again, be objective and not subjective from his work, and be able to go, that line sucks, and come back and rewrite it and still be open to suggestions. It's fresh. It's good. I got a patch on the back, buddy, because you never take credit for that.
Do we get to hear the line?
Oh, God.
What was the line? Well, I think we all banished it from our memory.
Yeah, we probably can't because I think it may maybe have a spoiler. Yeah, it was the one you guys were on the roof and the songbird. Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Oh, well.
We'll put the recording on like the collector's edition or something.
Maybe the gag reel?
Or not, we gag reel. Because it is recorded. And anybody who wants to, like, if I ever run for office and somebody wants to blackmail me, they can use that line.
So. That sounds like a lot of work to me. I mean, compared to, the fairly traditional process of you get your lines, maybe you talk to the director about them, you go through your scenes and you move on the next day. We had this great question from Terrence Ibar, who was reading something from Stephen Merchant, who voiced Wheatley in Valve's Portal 2. Great game, great voice acting. And somebody had asked him whether he would ever consider doing a sequel or a follow-up. And he basically said, absolutely not. It was just way too exhausting. I can't imagine ever revisiting this. You're looking at this incredible volume of work. Is this something you think you'd want to do again?
I knew how much work it was going to be because the recording that you saw, like just the emotional exhaustion, that happened on my callback. Like, I didn't even technically have the job yet. So I knew how much work it was going to be. And before my callback, we were sitting down and we were, Ken and Troy and I were talking about the project and what he wanted to do with it. So I kind of already had a little taste of the workshopping that Ken wanted to do, the collaborative effort, the emotional and physical work of it before I even had the job. And I took it knowing what it was going to be, because how can you pass up an opportunity like this? Like, for me, this is amazing. Like, someone said to me, like, oh, you got Bioshock? Like, working with Ken, that's like working with Steven Spielberg. Like, that's huge. You should be really excited about that. And for me, like, this is the biggest thing that I've ever done. It's the thing I'm the most proud of by far. And I would do it again in a heartbeat if I was offered the opportunity, because it doesn't really feel like work. It's challenging, but I like the challenge. And this experience has been so amazing. I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Troy, you do a ton of this work. It's clearly a major part of your career. You know, I've heard some voice actors talk about their love for doing this kind of work because they frankly get so much more screen time than they'd get even if they were doing a major motion picture, because you're in this game for hours at a time. Does it ever wear you down?
Oh, of course. I mean, I have a joke that says, we're not making a game till we're sweating and screaming. You know, that's really what it is. But it's so weird because I know a lot of people that, and great actors, that this is a stepping stone for them, or this is a side job for them. They have aspirations for film or for TV. I respect that and I commend that. For me, this is what I want to do. I think that video games are such a viable medium as a narrative. They're far more innovative, far more interesting than anything that's on TV, and unfortunately, even in theaters to a lot of extent now. And I'm loving the niche that I'm in, and I want to see it broaden. I read up on everything about the industry. I read up on I look at THQ stock, and I think about, like, I was blown away when like EA bought PopCap and what that could actually do for the industry. So this is my industry, and I feel just like any other skill, you need to be as well versed in the industry as possible. I think it's funny a lot of times, whether it be video games or animation or whatever kind of aspect of voice work, when a lot of times they'll bring in a celebrity. And this is someone who has got a cool voice, is an amazing actor, and they step into that arena and they're across from Steve Blum, Fred Tatasciore, Dee Bradley Baker, and yeah, we're talking Rob Paulsen, big guns. These guys have been doing this for a long time, and you just kind of see them shrink a little bit. Because all of the given the eyes and the looks that they're so used to doing and sells their performance isn't gone, and they're in a vacuum and they have to create something with just their voice. And I think that what we do is such a unique skill set. Just because you're a great actor doesn't mean that you're a good voice actor. It takes a specific skill set. So with what I'm doing now, this is what I want to keep doing, and I feel like we're really on, to pardon the cliche, but we're on the ground floor of this. And I'm not doing this so that I can get a guest star on CSI. I don't care about that. This is really what I want to do. And I think it's an incredibly precarious time for video games. I think that we're about to exponentially grow. I'm just not sure which direction that's going to be in. But I'm glad that I'm in a position to where I can grow with it. I just want to keep doing that.
I mean, Ken, this is a bit of a departure for you, investing so heavily in this sort of dialogue, relationship-intensive storytelling as opposed to the kind of environmental storytelling I think Irrational is more known for. Clearly, you guys are enjoying it. Clearly, you feel like it's working. Is this the new Irrational way of telling stories?
No, I think, each time we do, whether it's System Shock 2 or Bioshock 1 or this game, we try to add a layer of storytelling. In System Shock 2, we didn't have the ability to tell a story in the world. Only in a very limited way can we do that, and we tried to do that with, you know, with the very limited tools we had, because we didn't have the resources, and we didn't, and the engine just couldn't push the polygons. We relied heavily, heavily on the audio logs. In BioShock, we could basically keep the audio logs, but add a layer, which was the static visual space, as I pretentiously call the mise-en-scène, you know, of that game. You like that, guys?
Yes. Did you just pick that up in Europe?
Thank you, French word of the day.
You've been working on that accent for a while, haven't you?
Yeah, that was pretty good.
It's amazing.
Very good. This started, these characters started because we had a problem. And that problem was, is that we had sort of taken the Silent Cypher character in BioShock 1 and sort of exploded the notion of that, at least, you know, tried to explode the notion of that a little bit in the scene with Andrew Ryan. And it's very hard, once you burn that bridge, to go back and say, hey, kids, you know, forget about what we said about that Cypher character in the last game. You know, we have a, here's the new Cypher character. He's totally different. And so we generally decide, if we can't do something, to go in a completely opposite direction. Then we have to see, okay, well, now that we're in this opposite direction, now that we have Booker, well, what if there was somebody with him? What if there was a character with him? And then, well, who is that character? You know, what is the role of that character? Because it would be great for have Booker to have, it started as someone for Booker to talk to, you know, but then it became, well, this person needs, their story needs to be central to this world. And their relationship has to be central to this world. This is not just somebody who's sort of either giving him missions or joking with him. This is a character whose powers, both in the narrative and in the gameplay, have to be crucial. And it's also somebody who have a story that they're going through as well, along with Booker. And ideally, those stories need to intertwine, and they have to enable each other's journeys in a way. It came out of necessity. It didn't really come out of some spark of inspiration. But then once you have the necessity, then you find the spark.
We kind of had a direct challenge to that from one of the community members, Sean Kogan, who asked, you know, how will this focus on storytelling through characters jive with the rest of the BioShock series? Will it sort of keep the spirit of a BioShock game, given that you're now really inhabiting another person? You're not being yourself, as it were. I mean, do you worry at all that this is going to be jarring for players?
I don't worry really about, is it consistent with the BioShock franchise in a way, because I think that at the end of the day, the goal is to make a good game, the game that speaks for itself. So I don't have a checklist except for two basic principles I've talked about a lot, which is the kind of combat experience you have with weapons in one hand and powers in the other hand, and the kind of environment you're exploring. But beyond that, I don't really have a checklist of, okay, well, you know, we had this many vending machine types in that game, so we have to have that many vending machine types in this game. I think that limits where you can go, and it limits the risks you can take. And we started the very game with, you know, sort of throwing out a lot of what we had before. Now, that said, I think, and Troy referred to this before, there is this weird thing that is this experiment, which is you are Booker and you are yourself at the same time. So he's different from Elizabeth in the sense that Booker never wants to do something the player doesn't want to do. And that's a really fine line. And to some degree, it limits as a character what you do with Booker, but by necessity, because you never want that to conflict. Every word he comes out of his mouth, you sort of have to feel that that's earned. The player could sort of buy into it. And I think what generally that is why we're pushing for such a minimalistic approach is we choose the things he says and does very carefully. The things that he says and does that the player doesn't directly do, like talking, and we really try to pull back on it as much as possible. So there's enough space that the player is inhabiting most of that character. And that's very different from Elizabeth, who is a character that the player doesn't need to inhabit. But I think that it's going to be like the stuff we did in BioShock. There was no, you know, there was no Big Daddy, Little Sister in System Shock 2. And I think that you have to be open to coming up with new things and exploring new spaces.
And just to kind of tag on to that, from what I've seen, I mean, you look at Assassin's Creed. So Assassin's Creed's come out and everyone, you know, the reviews are great game, beautiful, visually stunning, just gets boring, gets very repetitive. So everyone at Ubi looked at that and went, okay, so what do we do here? Well, I'll tell you what, well, Grand Theft Auto is really impressive, so let's incorporate more of the sandbox into that. And Sims is a great game, so how about we make it to where you dress up your uncle's house, you know, and they started incorporating all of these different things that they felt would make it less repetitive and a better game. And then people complained about that. So you're going to find people on either side of the fence that say, keep it the exact same way. But if you do, it's, well, I remember that. It was just like this level in so-and-so. It was just like in Bioshock 1, or it's just like in System Shock. At the end of the day, I think Ken is right. You have to just make a good game. I don't care if it's, oh, wait, we can't do that because then it just looks like we're reusing data or we're reusing our assets. Make a good game. And that's what will shine through, as opposed to whether or not it's being repetitive or it's consistent or in the spirit of the game.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to hit a couple of the questions we had that were really about sort of the story and the actual relationship. And obviously, we can't get in too much into spoiler territory, but we have one great question from James Madison that I really wanted to ask Courtney, which was, what does Elizabeth see when she looks at Booker? And do you ever think that when and do you ever think that when you're looking at Booker, when you're looking at Troy, that he's actually replaced by the player? When Elizabeth looks at Booker, when you're looking at Troy, what you're actually looking at is the shell that's going to be the player. Do you ever
that is a, wow. That's a fantastic question. And I mean, I don't even know how to, I've never thought about that. I mean,
that's a great perspective.
That's a really good.
Yeah.
That's an amazing question to think of that. I'm stumped.
How do you think Elizabeth looks at Booker, right? From what we've seen so far. I mean, what's going on in her head when she first encounters Booker?
I feel like, I don't think she knows what to think. Like, she is, I mean, I don't know how much we can talk about, but she is rocketed into this world that she thought she knew what it was going to be like, and then it's completely different, and then she's dealing with, you know, Booker, who she doesn't know who she can trust. She doesn't know what's real. She doesn't, it's just chaotic and crazy. And I feel like Elizabeth is trying to navigate and figure out, like, is this someone that I can trust? What kind of woman do I want to be? Like, bouncing those ideas off of her interactions with Booker. And you see these moments where she falls into line with what he wants her to do, and then other moments where she says, screw you, like, I don't care what you fucking want me to do, I'm gonna do this. Like, I feel like she doesn't even know what she's really looking at when she sees Booker or the player or whomever, because she doesn't have anything to compare it to. Everything is very new for her. So I think whenever she's looking at anybody, she's just looking at someone in a very intense way, trying to figure out what they want from her, trying to figure out if she can trust them. And I think that people feel connected to that, because how often in the world do people really look at you and really want to see you for who you are? I think that's compelling, and that's kind of what makes that character work.
Troy, let me turn that back to you. I mean, do you ever think when you're being Booker, when you're inhabiting that character, do you ever sort of think about the fact that you are, in fact, the shell that millions of people are going to inhabit?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've always been weird. I mean, Tron, the original, not the sequel, but Tron changed my life, and it opened up the world to me that the fact that everybody that is playing in a game is like a sentient being. It's a real life. Please don't think that I'm weird that I think that. But I definitely think that. And again, especially with the character of Booker in this game, we have to be consistently aware of that, because if we're not, mm-hmm. I think we lose. And honestly, I think I approach this more as a gamer or as a player than I do as an actor. Because it's really kind of very easy. The script and the dialogue and the story is so good. I just kind of have to be caught up in the ebb and flow and just go with it. But what I want to make sure that I do is never have that moment as a gamer where I would be taken out of the story. Like, I hate in moments of the game where, you know, you're standing there and you've got the bad guy dead to rights and you're looking at him with your gun. And you're like, now monologue for me. Tell me what you were like as a child so I can understand your process. You know, just shoot him and let's go. I hate those moments. So I always want to make sure that Booker never falls into that territory where the player's going, fuck this, man, I'm out of here, because I would have done this. The second that we open up the opportunity for the player to go, I would have done this, I've lost. I haven't done my job. And my job is to make sure that the player is always going through, always going through every decision going, that's exactly what I would have done. Yes, that the game has an intuitive feel to it. So yeah, I definitely think that I see things from the eyes of the player. Because how often do you get to be a part of something that you're going to geek out over later, you know? So again, it's kind of the unique perspective. And I think that Courtney and I are perfect in that, because I couldn't do what Courtney's doing and Courtney can't do what I'm doing, because I think it takes our real life individual perspectives and experience to be able to put that into the characters, because they're really just extensions of us. You've got one guy who's jaded, who has a lot of experience, and you've got one girl who's naive and innocent and hasn't had a lot of experience.
Are you saying that's how I am in real life?
Are you talking about the game you're trying?
I was giving you the benefit of the doubt. Jeez.
Dude, no one would describe me that way.
Courtney is as pure as the driven snow.
Oh, yes. The driven snow.
But
been rode a lot.
I was being nice, damn it.
We have a great question from James Allen, who talks about the recognizability of certain people's voices. Was that a concern when you were casting for the role of Booker?
I've never been a fan of finding a star, Charlie was talking about this before, to play a part, because, you know, there's a bunch of issues with it. One is, you know, the point of, like, when, you know, an Arnold Schwarzenegger does a movie, it's because generally he's being Arnold Schwarzenegger, and people, that's what they're paying for. They want to see that. And we're not really trying to do that here. We want to suspend disbelief, and especially with Booker, you want the player to slide into that. And to some degree, the more that is, the player can imprint their own personality on that, the better. So, you know, I don't think having somebody recognizable there is a terrific idea. There's other issues when you deal with, especially very famous people, in terms of the amount of time they can put in. And sometimes it's to them, it's, unlike Troy and Courtney, it's like, yeah, well, this is, you know, I'm slumming here. I'm here for the paycheck. You know, and Troy and Courtney, I think, are there for the work. If you don't have somebody who's there for the work, you really are not going to get good work out of them. I don't care how famous they are. That doesn't give me a thrill. I'd rather be working with two actors who are incredibly invested than a name that I've seen in giant letters on a movie marquee.
But does it change how you write the character? I mean, Troy commented about avoiding those moments where you don't believe what your character just said. How do you write around that issue?
You probably write it wrong to some degree. I'm guessing we'll end up, as we go on, realize a number of the lines are too Booker and not enough the player. I'm guessing that will happen as we do the work. But right now, I'm not trying to worry about that too much, because that's something we can fix, you know, later on. I'm trying not to spend too much time worrying about that. I definitely have that in my head. I'm running that, you know, sort of as a subroutine as I'm writing. You just have to be very conscious of it. But there's a million things as a writer. One of the bad things as me as a writer is I have enough game development experience is that I've been an executive producer. I've been a project lead. I've been a lead designer. I've been all those things. And I know technically what has to happen and what's going to work technically and what's not going to work technically. And I can't shut those voices off while I'm writing. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I try with this one, I know we'll be able to go back and clean that up on a case-by-case basis if we feel that it steps on the player's toes.
I mean, are you recording lots of sort of extra takes just in case? Like, well, here's 11 ways we might use this line, and we're not sure which one we're going to do yet, so you record it 11 different ways?
Well, we don't really sort of record it 11 different ways. We just sort of play with the actors, play with the line, and we get, gosh, guys, I don't know how many. We get sometimes 15, 20 takes of an individual line. We generally get a lot. And there are some technical things. Like, you have to get a lot. Like, if Elizabeth has a line or Booker has a line, depending on how far away they are from each other, we have to have a sort of spoken version of the line and a shouted version of the line.
Right.
We don't know how far they're going to be from it. The game will know at runtime, but we don't know. So that's one technical thing you have to do. And then you just want a ton of variety, because you want to give the future Ken as much material when he's working with Justin and Christina in the editing booth so he can have as much material to choose from. And that means that director Ken has to tire himself out and tire the actors out more in the session and get take after take after take after take.
I like how you talk about yourself in the third person and your multiple personalities.
From now on, that's what I'm going to do, and I'd appreciate your...
Director Ken, what he think is, and then future Ken is going to step in, and he's going to want this.
What Ken Levine is really saying is...
and then there's douchebag of, Ken, who... You know,
right. Which we get to see a lot.
We had a great question from Nick Borrego, and I thought I'd ask it to sort of everybody. Ken, you wrote a bunch, you recorded a bunch, you change it, you come back, you record some more. How have your impressions of your characters evolved over time? And is it in line with the actual story? I mean, do you start at the beginning and you record the ending bits later, and all of a sudden you're learning things about your character you never knew? Maybe Courtney, you could start.
Oh, Wait, one more time? I'm sorry. I thought you were asking Ken, and I thought, oh, I'm going to go check this text message. That's terrible. It's the truth, though.
Oh, that's still, at least you're honest. I'll reset.
I had no choice but to be honest. Like, I have nothing.
Actually, Courtney, when you were answering your question, I was having sex with a prostitute. So, you know, it all works out.
Perfect. Is that like husband Ken had sex with the prostitute or director Ken?
All right, Courtney, this has definitely been an iterative process. Ken writes some, you record some, Ken writes some more, you record some more. How has your character evolved through that process, your understanding of Elizabeth and Booker? And are you learning things about this character all the way through to the end?
In other projects, you would get a script. I know the whole arc of my character, and then through rewrites and whatever, it evolves. It can have something to compare it to. Trey and I are in the dark about a lot of what's going on in this game. So it's not necessarily that I see her evolving from how she necessarily started out to be. But every time I go in and we workshop, or every time I go in and I get new information about her, of course I'm learning about her, just as the character will be learning about her as the story continues on. And that's cool, because I feel like I'm kind of getting a little bit in the experience that the player is going to get, because it's not like I just know where Elizabeth begins and then where her story ends. It's an arc for me as well. And in terms of in the actual game, she has this arc of figuring out who she is. And then in terms of creating the game, that's what we're all doing too. I think Ken's still figuring it out, working with us, and I'm trying to figure it out, and Troy's getting a sense of who she is. But just like in life, you know, people and these characters are continuing to evolve, and it's nothing that is set in stone to my knowledge.
I think that when we started off, you know, a lot of people would say it's like looking at a blank canvas, but I don't think that's what we were doing. I think that we were looking at a block of granite, and everything was there. All of the elements were there. All we simply had to do is start chipping away at things, and we're creating this thing together. And sometimes you have to step back, and that gives you the perspective to see, oh, that's right, this is where we're going. And you go back into it, and you're really close to it, and you keep working away, and you step back, and you look, and this is where we're going. There's one of two ways to approach this. Either we know everything, we know how it ends, so we know how we're going to get there, or you can go the opposite direction, which is to be like the characters, and we're kind of fumbling and stumbling our way through this story, just as Booker and Elizabeth are stumbling their way through the city. And I think there's pros and cons to either way of doing that. I like doing this because I like being surprised. And I think that Booker has evolved is one way to look at it, but I think it's more of my approach to and my connection to Booker has more evolved. Because as we get into this more, and as more, you know, layers get added in and more scenes to where I've got more substance to wrap my hands around, it goes from just being this character that I do to really being who Booker is. And it makes me want to go back to some of the earlier stuff and go, I think I would change this. But yeah, I think by the time we land at the ending and when we actually have everything completed, it's really going to give us this sense that we accomplished something. It's like we climbed this mountain together and now it all makes sense. And it's kind of like that David Fincher moment where you look back and you go, oh my God, that's what he was doing the entire time, you know? So yeah, I definitely think that the characters have evolved. I think we have too.
I mean, Ken, are you actually writing it and sort of developing the game in that kind of linear fashion where you start writing and recording and developing the assets and the levels for the beginning of the game and just work straight on through in the same order the player is going to play? It doesn't seem possible.
No, it's not possible. And the writing is not happening, you know, that way either. Well, we've been towards the beginning. And in fact, like we did the very beginning encounter with Booker and Elizabeth in the last session we did a couple of weeks ago. And I wrote that right before that. So I have to write out of sequence, but we have a plan. You know, we have a macro plan. I just haven't. And we have the levels broken out in terms of what's going to happen in them. And the story arc has been broken out for a long time. And I'm just sort of now writing the actual dialogue for the lines. And, the reason I haven't shared a lot of what's going to happen with Troy and Courtney is because I want them to not overprocess it. You know, like they were saying, they just want to sort of be in the moment and do it. And in fact, I don't generally send them the scripts ahead of time. You know, we just sort of go to each line, we just sort of, here's a new line, guys. It's the first time they see it. And then we talk about it for a minute and then we do it. And, you know, these guys have been excellent at this. There's a lot to sort of keep in our heads. There's a lot of multiple threads running, and they've been very good about keeping those threads running. Certainly my job, and I have great help from people on my team, is keeping it all sane, keeping it all in order, because it's a huge script. And it's different things can happen. So sometimes you're working on things, you know, little plot moments that are mutually exclusive from one another. And it's a very complicated thing. And it's done out of order and it's missing chunks, you know. And so you do the best you can just to keep everybody on the right page and trust that we can pick things up in the future if we really get something wrong.
So that's pretty much it for me. Ken, is there anything else you want to hit?
No, I got to run to my next meeting, and I'm so offended by Courtney texting that I'm really...
I wasn't, like, actively, you know, it was just like a little, like, hey, maybe I'll look at this and see what's going on. I'm very social. I've got a lot of things going on.
You have a lot of friends.
I do. I'm very
kind of a big deal. Is that what you're going for?
Kind of a big deal. Yeah.
So, guys, it's always great to hang out with you, even in this mode. And I'm looking forward to, I think, a couple of weeks we're going to be hanging out together again.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Which means I have to start writing.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
This podcast was produced by Jim Bonney, Julian Murdoch, and Eduardo Vasconcelos. Editing by Ant Bear Audio. Music by The Happy Hollows.